Hello, kids. Matt Segundo here, and I'd like to talk to you about women, specifically older women. My own experiences with them have been, shall we say, a tad rocky, and not the kind of rocky that causes a mattress to undulate or a hand to shake after a Saturday night bender. It seems that as an older gentleman, I am not the only one. The problem, then, lies somewhere within this divide. Women want sex. Men like me want sex. Love, such as it is sometimes an afterthought. I have not trusted this idea of love for quite some time, particularly when my only context for this comes with Doris sending me a Hallmark card every birthday with a polite note asking for her alimony check. I think the time has come for less Hallmark cards along these lines and simply more sex, or more acknowledgement that we all want it. Or perhaps we should simply confess the truth. Some of us ain't getting any.
Okay, so I am here with Jane Ganahl, a columnist and journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and most recently the author of Naked on the Page. Jane, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. It's a beautiful day in San Francisco.
Yes, this is why the winters are good here.
Yes, exactly.
I wanted to, first of all, actually tie this book in with... You're familiar with the infamous Newsweek article 20 years ago, where they basically claimed that if you were a woman over 40...
Your chances were better of being hit by lightning or killed by a terrorist than of getting married again.
Yes. Of course, they issued basically an apology for this last year, but I wanted to actually ask you about... Since this perception from one of our most major news weeklies, still these things hover in the air, where does this book come in, and how does it kind of tie in with this notion of a cultural sort of stigma upon life after 40 as a woman in a romantic sense and the like?
I think that in the beginning of the book, I was sort of victimized still by that whole mindset that, oh my God, I'm over 40, I'm closing it. Actually, I was closing in on 50. I'm never going to get married again, and I was really genuinely terrified. But after, I don't want to give away the book. It is a memoir, but basically, it's sort of the story of my emotional journey to kind of get through some of those issues and some of those stigmas about being in your 40s and not married, and sort of hopefully overcoming that so that women can see that, you know what, life is pretty great as a single person.
Mm-hmm. Well, simultaneously, in this book, you sort of constantly are in search of the mythical Leo, both through the course of the book and also through the course of your column, Single Minded.
Right.
I wanted to kind of ask you about the interrelationship between your column and writing this book. I wanted to actually ask you, I know it ended last year.
Right.
What caused it to end? How does the book relate to the column? Perhaps you can elaborate on this.
Well, the columns led directly to the book in that after... I don't know, a few years of writing it, and it was very popular. I got more mail than just about anybody at the paper.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple of different agents approached me and said, you should really turn some of this into a book. And I'd never written a book, so I was a little taken aback. Eventually I sort of... started writing a proposal and realized that it was not going to work to just do a compilation of columns, because nobody can do that and have it sell unless you're Dave Barry or maybe Maureen Dowd or something. And so I sort of pulled back and decided I would focus on just 15 months of my life from the time I started the column until I turned 50.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are parts of my actual columns in the book.
Yes.
I use them as sort of show readers, where my mind was at the time. And why did I leave the Chronicle? It's very complicated. The rest of my bio is that, I also edited an anthology of women writers called Single Woman of a Certain Age, and I co-direct the Litquake Literary Festival in San Francisco. So basically I had a few years there with no weekends at all, and I was absolutely dangerously burned out. And come this summer I just decided something had to go. And what was I enjoying the least? Well, it wasn't writing this book, it was my Chronicle job. So So that's where I departed.
What's interesting about this book too is that in the moments that you feature the column, you actually respond to it later. And I was wondering if the book was in some way a way to kind of revisit some of the issues that you had explored in the book, or a way to kind of what was I really sort of thinking
here? Oh, exactly. Yeah. In fact, I went back and read, you know, obviously all of my columns, and it's they started now about almost, was it five years ago or 6 years ago now? I've lost track. But I was in a very different mindset, and it was kind of painful to have to read some of those early columns and recall that I was feeling at that time much less strong than I do now and more needy and more confused. And so, but I thought, you know, part of me didn't want to address that and just sort of write it from my current perspective. But I thought, well, that's cheating the audience because pretty much every woman goes through those feelings of insecurity and shouldn't I be married and why am I single and what's wrong with me and all those kind of tedious questions.
Well, also the interesting thing, too, is that in terms of sitting down and really kind of writing this book versus the column, you reference the fact that you were, and in this conversation, the notion of being this sort of email junkie, this person who sort of thrives on feedback. Now, when you were writing this book, obviously you didn't have that particular advantage, and I'm wondering how you kind of rewired things or reset things so that you could actually go ahead and focus your attention on something where, unlike your column, every chapter wasn't necessarily going to get a fuselage of feedback.
Oh, I know. Yeah. It was a real learning experience. I didn't have any idea what I was doing when I set out to write this book. I thought, you know, well, I can write. If I can write a column, I can write a book. Well, guess what? You know, it's an entirely different muscle that you're flexing if you're going to write a book. You have to keep this huge sort of huge project, this big picture in mind, as opposed to, you know, 1,000 words that I have to be cogent and to the point and make my point forcefully and have that run on Sunday. So yeah. It was a big, big shift for me.
Well, what about the feedback aspect?
Oh, and the feedback aspect, yeah. It was tempting to kind of, at the end of each chapter, send it to somebody. And I did that occasionally. I'd send a chapter to a friend who would read it and they'd say, you know, give some feedback. But I just decided to tough it out, you know, without the feedback, because I would find that getting feedback was more confusing to me than it would be to just sort of plow right through. So that was really weird, honestly, I really thrived on the feedback. Mm.
Did you, without the feedback, I mean, you know, was this more of a struggle? I mean, what role does feedback sort of play in your writing? You're still contributing at various other sort of places, and you still get instant feedback, and so
the role of feedback in a columnist's life is really important, I think, because you know, you throw these ideas out in the world and you try to make them as original as possible so that you're not just parroting something somebody else has said. And so the feedback that you get, you know, even if it's distressing and angry and hateful, is all, you know, kind of goes into the mill for your future work. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of process it and you keep going and you incorporate some things and toss others. So it's very important, and it was really odd to not have any feedback for 5 months as I was writing this book. So
I wanted to actually ask you about the journalist's curse that you mentioned in the book, that you and Phil Bronstein suffer from, where you're a journalist, therefore you're always sort of right. Now, this is probably going to be a very kind of troublesome mindset to kind of, you know, negotiate as you are sort of trying to reassess yourself and reassess your feelings and reassess your sort of state of mind and the like. So what did you do to kind of, you know, I guess, get yourself out of thinking these preconceived notions of like, well, I know that this is right, I know this is right, no, this is right?
I didn't handle it very well, to be honest. It's sort of like, you know, I would write a column, I would think I was right because, you know, I did my research and everything, and I would get these torpedoes from people saying, you're so full of crap, I was really indignant, and at first I would just sort of dismiss it out of hand. Well, you know, I am not good at taking criticism. I'm really not. Mm-hmm. And that was a very new experience for me being a columnist because, you know, I did pop music criticism, and when you do that, you also get some hate mail, but nothing like when you sort of talk about your own personal feelings on things. So it just took some time to learn. You know, I mean, I always thought, I still think I'm right. So I obviously haven't learned it very well.
I'm wondering if you felt that the gates widened because you were no longer writing for a family newspaper, no longer writing like these, I got to crank this thing out by Wednesday so the copy editor looks at it. What sort of changed in terms of like perhaps the book versus the newspaper?
Oh, it was like the best, most liberating feeling I've ever had as a writer, you know, knowing that, boy, I could totally make this chapter twice as long as this is if I wanted to, or I could really go into some detail, which I can never, ever do. I could never go, you know, in my newspaper stories, you know, really, really go into detail on what this person looked like or, you know, that kind of thing. And it was very, very liberating. And to be honest with you now, I read this book and I'm already working on my next one. And I think this next one's even going to be better because this first one was a real learning experience in that regard.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about, first of all, you spend a good deal of time in this book constantly referencing your age, your quote frumpiness,
and
all of that, and how these two physical qualities preclude you from like snagging a man. Now, I wanted to actually sort of offer the other argument, and isn't it not necessarily about this sort of appearance, but about having some sort of sense of confidence? This kind of issue wasn't really explored so much in this book, and I was wondering why you didn't kind of dwell upon it as much, because, I mean, a lot of look at Jane Juska, you know.
I know.
I mean, there's a woman with some considerable confidence.
Exactly.
And look how she's managed to parlay it.
And you're referencing the woman who wrote Around Hill Woman at age 70, where she was having all kinds of sex. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I hope that, in a way, I hope that readers who read my sort of laments in the book we'll see them transparently, which is like, you know, well, this woman, like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Is she not getting men because she's unattractive, or is she still relatively attractive but has no confidence because she's let this get into her head that she's not, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but yeah, you're right. I wish I could have done a better job with sort of expressing how when women would write me, for example, when I was doing the column. Oh, and we're having
that's
Italian
her,
pop
yeah, exactly.
music. When women would write me, I would say it's about how you carry yourself, and it's about how you, you know, express yourself, and how smart you are too. So, obviously, it's one of these do as I say, not as I do kind of things, because I didn't practice that myself. I'm feeling much better about myself now.
Okay. Well, I guess though, I mean, since this is a very pivotal issue in terms of how I can have a sort of delayed romantic life, so to speak. I mean, why not just, you know, why did you decide to concentrate on these neuroses you had as opposed to, like, well, wait a minute, Jane, I'm, you know, feeling that this is just utterly ridiculous. I mean, you acknowledge that at several points.
Yeah.
You know, you're racing around, for example, for this guy from Louisiana, and you're looking around for the perfect outfit for this first date, and of course it turns out to be completely different from what you
expected. Disastrous date, yes.
But at the same time, though, you know, you dwell upon the neuroses, but you don't dwell specifically upon how it pertains to you. I mean, why care about, like, what the hell you wear? I interviewed Mary Gateskill, and she was, like, wearing this total punk rock t-shirt, you know?
You know, it just all depends on the woman and her wiring, you know? I mean, I was the product of a mother who always was perfectly turned out, and that was, you know, something I grew up with, that you always had to look perfect. And so it took a lot for me to actually overcome that in my life, because I'm certainly not perfect, ever. But, I don't know. Nowadays, I sort of encourage women to just kind of find their own style and go for it. Mary Gateskill probably looks great in a punk rock T-shirt.
Yeah.
You know, and don't compromise. I mean, sort of dress what feels good to you. And I do that better now than I ever have. So.
Well, at the same time, it's like it's not necessarily about like the aesthetic of looking good in a punk rock T-shirt. It's about the sort of like, hey,
how you feel.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I was going to ask. Oh, yeah. You also wrote in this, I can also see that I am missing the love boat by spending my evenings at literary events. Again, is this really the case? I mean, isn't it a matter of sort of hanging around with like-minded people? I mean, you know, and you have this social set that you indicate in this book throughout. I mean.
Yes, in fact, and again, it's another do as I say, not as I do, because that's how I've actually met a number of people in recent years, is at literary events. Because you, and that's the advice I always give people who write me, you know, how do I meet somebody? Well, find out what you love, figure out what you love, whether it's music or books or art or ballet, and go do it. Just do it, you know, and you'll meet people who love the same thing, and it works out. So, yes, you're calling me on the fact that I was young and immature when I wrote those words.
Yes, but this was only a matter of a few years ago.
Four and a half.
Okay,
yeah.
Well,
I'm almost 55 now.
Okay, well, fair enough. Well, then, in that case, I actually wanted to actually ask you about, like, this notion of having it all. Okay, so love life, problematic.
Right.
But at the same time, you've had a really successful journalist career. You've organized LitQuick, as you proudly announced to me. You have a social set of first names preoccupying this book in which the local San Francisco literati can probably sort of fill in the details. Isn't there a sort of a case where you kind of have to accept what, you know, makes you happy?
And, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that if there is a happy conclusion to the book, it's that you kind of, in the book, I sort of think that it takes me all of these pages to kind of discover what love is about. And it's not necessarily from the elusive boyfriend who's in and out of my life.
Yes.
But from, you know, family who's very constant, and my daughter who's just an extraordinary person, and my friends. And so, yes, I consider myself among the, you know, happiest of people at this time.
But
so.
I'm just wondering why this didn't necessarily come across in the book, because it was, again, as I sort of have suggested, a lot of neuroses were expressed in terms of, like, you know, even by your own admission, you're constantly sort of judgmental of yourself in this book.
Right.
You're sitting there ripping up your own columns saying, oh my God, I can't believe I expressed this. This is only like a matter of a year after you've written the column.
Right.
I mean, why not sort of acknowledge this notion of like the happiness in your life?
I think I do. I think I do towards the end. I would argue that, you know, in the last chapters, I sort of go through the fire and come back out the other side and am able to find much more joy in the things that I do have in my life. I just think that, and the women, it's only been on the market for a week, but the women who've already emailed me and said, you know, oh God, I've been so there, and it's nice to hear it expressed. And so you don't, you know, you can write a book for two reasons. You can write it to, I could have written a self-help book and said, how to be happy after 50,
yeah.
You know, but I don't feel like, it's not like any, I don't have that 100% nailed, nor does anybody. But what you can do is let people kind of go on that journey with you and get frustrated with your negativity, and so that in the end you're coming through the fire and coming to a more positive place. Is it feels more rewarding. I guess that's my only.
For you then, it's basically a matter of just essentially sort of spilling out these sort of flaws and allowing, I guess,
yes,
your audience to sort of fill in the details.
Yeah, and you know, I've never been a drug addict, or you know, I didn't have that kind of colorful history. My worst flaws in life is that I was, you know, a negative whiner, basically. So, you know, you turn 50, you learn a lot of things, and I learned a lot that year, and that's kind of what's reflected in the book.
I wanted to actually ask you about the nature of your confessional writing, both in this book and in the column.
Uh-huh.
Do you find, you kind of alluded a couple of times, that there's a certain kind of therapy to some degree. Do you believe in the notion of writing as therapy, or is how does writing relate to your person?
Oh, I very much think it does. There were a number of incidents in the book that were taken, you know, from real life and then reflected in a column. It was all mixed up in there, but say if something negative happened, and my friend Phil was always like, oh, write about it, just write about it, fine. So I'd write about it, and I would find that in the course of writing about something negative that happened, like a romantic, you know, debacle or whatever, that as I wrote about it, I would sort of, as a columnist, you have to force yourself to have a little bit of perspective.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you'd find yourself saying, well, how come this happened? And maybe for men it's like this, and for women it's like this, and maybe women are too sensitive, or I don't know, whatever. So as you kind of find yourself reasoning it out, so that for the sake of the reader, you know, it kind of helps you come to terms with it. And the book did that for me as well, writing the book.
What of this notion of dwelling upon something for a time? I mean, obviously this wasn't a luxury as a columnist, because you had an insane sort of deadline,
right,
you had to write something that week. But with the book, you could have revisited some of these things, and again, it seemed to me anyway to be this sort of just kind of spilled confessional in which, you know, the reader can see the details that he or she wants to. So I'm wondering why perspective was, you know, that you could have provided in this book, why you just, you know, you opted more for the confessional over the sort of more ruminative.
I think I chose to write, this is an oblique answer, but I think I chose to write in the present tense for the reason that I felt like it was more immediate and it would sort of help people go through it with me.
Okay.
As opposed to if I'd written it now in my 54th year, about my 49th year, I would have had, I could have shed more perspective. I could have said, you know, I didn't get it yet that, you know, blah, blah, blah. But as it was, I chose to do it very immediately, like as week by week, as month by month, because it progressed over a year, that people kind of went through it with me. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that was the best decision, but it seems to be resonating with people, so we'll see.
Well, you also you define yourself as a sort of a fair to good writer early on in the book. And again, I'm going back to this sort of issue of confidence and about this notion of having some sort of contemplation. I mean, is exploring, particularly when you're doing this sort of deeply personal things, is introspection a real difficult aspect for you when you're writing something?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I was in tears like almost every day writing this book, unless I was writing about a particularly funny thing that happened. But there's a fair amount in there about my loss as well, and I lost my mother and sister within a year of each other, and my daughter went to college, and I was sort of at loose ends, and you know, there's four or five pretty major like romantic disasters in there that even writing about those made me get tearful because it was, I chose to write in the present tense so that people could kind of just go ouch, you know, along with me when the first boyfriend from college says, oh, you know, I thought you'd still be as thin as you used to be. So yes, it is very difficult to write introspectively about things that happened.
What then is the relationship between you, the writer, sort of exposing yourself, as you say, you know, dropping your panties down in the column.
Naked on the page.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the title, Naked on the Page, versus a reader who might be, you know, of whatever perspective, tapping into this and sort of, I guess, what would be the Venn diagram between you, Jane Goodall, and the reader? What do you see as the sort of connection
point? I think anytime you put out your own story, if you're being emotionally honest about it, as I tried to be in this book, the connection is that it sort of hits a deep, dark place in other people, you know, you know, the women, I keep saying women. Actually, I got a ton of email from men when I was doing this column, which always shocked me. I always got almost 50% from men. But, you know, they would say that oh, gosh, I thought I was alone. I thought I was the only person that thought that. And so I guess if you're talking about the connecting point, it would be vulnerability. And, you know, you talk about your fears and you'll find that other people have the same ones.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, there's the, speaking of reader response, there's the infamous moment where you make a generalization about men and about how they're always sort of, you know, getting cold and complain about it, and that you got this extraordinary sort of email reaction because of that. There seems to be, I mean, you know, and you also, there's one quote I do believe where you had mentioned that they, you know, that the men would, I can't remember it exactly, but the men would essentially firebomb the Chronicle building if they knew everything that you wanted to say. So what then is, there's a part of you clearly that does like to sort of raise a ruckus by announcing something like that. I mean, obviously, you know, you had to know what was going to happen when you wrote that. And then there's also a part, but then obviously there's a part of you that can only write so much. So I guess, how does this tie in with this sort of expression of your personal experience?
Well, I mean, I knew that when I started writing the column that, you know, Phil especially really wanted me to be as controversial as possible. And I'm a very opinionated person. I had no problem with expressing myself. But I think I was unprepared emotionally for the backlash backlash is too strong a word. The negative response when I would, and the comment you're referring to was when I was saying how I wrote a column about how single life is at its worst when you're sick and you don't have anybody to wipe your nose or whatever. And I said something about, of course, all men are babies when they get sick, but that's a whole nother column is what I wrote. And just that one line kind of embedded in this other column was just, the onslaught. But I learned some things. I certainly learned some things that I can't be flippant and say these stereotypic things without hearing about it, you know, people calling you on your, you know, crap. And so it was, you know, every Sunday I'd go through this in psychology, they called it approach avoidance. Like, I wanted to read my emails, but I didn't. I'd circle around it for a while because I'd know I would just get a full screen full of, you know, reactions, both people saying, oh, you're the best thing that ever happened to the paper, and others saying, when are they going to fire you, you know, and get rid of this stupid piece of crap. So I think I was unprepared for the amount of response I was going to get.
Well, you also described that it was only really Phil actually going up to bat for you that allowed you to get the column in the first place,
yeah,
which suggests to me that the role of having these particular issues played out in the newspaper, particularly now when we're seeing like Anna Nicole Smith everywhere, you know, given these restrictions, given the Newsweek example I cited from the beginning, is it just a matter of just these books coming out? Is it just a matter of like fluke occurrences of Phil going up to bat for you?
God, that's a good question. I think that these kinds of books are going to start coming out no matter what. I feel like the paradigm is shifting a little bit. You know, there was that New York Times story a couple weeks ago, which has since been tempered a bit.
Yeah, the conservatives.
The numbers weren't quite right, but it was the one where they said 51% of all American women are now living without a spouse. Well, it's not that many, but even if it's 49 or 50%, it's a huge number, and it represents a pretty significant sea change. And so, yeah, it was sort of serendipity that I started writing this column, and then the column led to the book. On the other hand, I feel like I'm just sort of I'm riding a rising tide, I guess, of the demographic shift in the country, which is that so many more women are remaining unmarried and kind of grappling with that, you know, mostly seeing it as a good thing, but not really being so sure because we don't have any role models.
Yeah.
You know, our mothers, for the most part, were all married. And so, you know, we're the first generation of this massive divorce trend, and now we're deciding where to go from there. So
I was also curious why you didn't really allude too much to your husbands in this, because you mentioned, of course, your second husband, who you're still on good terms with. You compared him to Chevy Chase at one point.
Right.
But I'm wondering why you didn't sort of reveal why those relationships failed or why you weren't happy, because perhaps that would have allowed a reader, particularly like a middle-aged reader who's also contemplating, okay, look, I've got the career, I've got everything else going on in my life, but the love quotient isn't actually happening.
You know, you're right about that. There's a very good reason why I didn't write more about my first husband, and that's because he's my daughter's father, and she is very attached to him, and she doesn't mind being written about. I've written about her for years, but I think that's her line in the sand. You know, she's never said that to me, but it's just something that I respect. I feel like, you know, I just had to respect that. And so basically I just sort of left it that, you know, we married at 22 and 20 years of age, and we were just too young. And that is the main reason right there. I outgrew him literally within a few years. I was restless and bored and thinking, what did I do? There wasn't anything more horribly insidious than that. But I did the same thing with my second marriage. I felt like I just felt restless and like I was being smothered and not, you know. I think women have it in their DNA, and they're also given all these messages that they're the caretakers. And so here I had with this very rambunctious 8-year-old daughter when I came to this marriage and a new husband, and I felt like I had to do everything for her and keep him happy and keep that, you know, and it was just too much for me. So
maybe then we have this kind of wandering instinct, or this sort of notion of moving on,
right,
which, you know, I would say is perfectly acceptable, but at the same time, here you are, and the purpose of your column is like, I've got to find Leo, and the purpose of this book, I've got to find the right person. And you know, I mean, maybe to some degree, like this Lenny character, for example, may have been, you know, may have fulfilled this wandering sort of idea. I mean, you know, maybe it's just a matter of that. Maybe some people just aren't meant to be married, and I'm just wondering why you didn't just come out and
I did. I did, actually. There's one chapter in the book that I think is fairly pivotal when I go back and revisit some college friends for a reunion.
Right. Yeah.
And they talked about how when we were all young, I basically used to always mouth off about the fact that I don't want to be married. What do I want to be married for? I don't want to be tied down. And I had actually forgotten that I said all those things. And so it was really, really interesting for me in real life as well as in the book to recall that and say, well, and I think I even said, you know, maybe I wasn't meant to be married. Maybe I have that kind of restless spirit that you know needs me, keeps me needing to, you know, move on or whatever.
I think I kind of maybe didn't catch that because I now remember that statement exactly, but it seemed to me it was being couched more in terms of how you stood out, like when you were naming
a
number of partners and things like that.
Yeah,
you know,
that was one of the chapters I refused to let my dad read. By the way, I just gave him the book last night. I said, "You cannot read these chapters," and I line about anyway.
But I guess because it's so like directed towards how you stand out from these women, as opposed to saying, "Look, I happen to be this type of woman," and maybe you might be too.
Well, it was really kind of all. You're right. The discussion kind of came up around the fact that, you know, it turns out I'd slept with many, many, many more men than my friends, and that's when it came up that my friend said, "Well, you always said you didn't want to be married." I said, "Oh," so it was sort of the double whammy of those two revelations, and I don't know. It then and now that really impacted me.
I guess though, I mean, why frame this within the course of putting the arc light on yourself? As opposed to, you know, I mean, granted, one can only do so much in a memoir, but the notion of, you know, basically assessing why the institution of marriage doesn't work for some people, or assessing why...
That's my next book. Okay. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. And I actually wrote about that in my column a fair amount, why marriage fails a lot of people, or people fail marriage because, you know... some people are just meant to be independent, you know, and need huge amounts of personal space. And I think I've come to the conclusion that I'm one of those people, but it took me years to kind of figure that out. And, you know, it's not like I'm anti-marriage. Yeah. I feel like I know some incredibly happily married couples, and I just think that it's incumbent on each individual to kind of figure out what their limitations are and not beat themselves up if marriage doesn't work for them, you know.
But here you are in this book beating yourself up,
I too. Totally beat myself up because I was still in that zone of questioning and in that zone of feeling bad about myself that I could not never make it work, you know, as a lot of women do, like every day. Women, like, why am I not married, you know? Yeah. And I hope, if anything, women... people can read this book and realize that, you know, they need to stop doing what I did to myself quite liberally at that time.
Yeah, so really it's not a matter of really, I guess, analyzing the issue, but just presenting a sort of case study.
Yeah,
your
case study. Exactly. And in fact, it actually occurred to me at one point to write not a self-help book, but, you know, a book examining marriage and how it works and how it doesn't, but I don't have that kind of discipline. I just thought, if I could write my own case study, then people might either learn from it or be repelled by it, one or the two. And even being repelled by something, you learn something.
Gotcha. Well, actually, I wanted to actually ask you. You note in the acknowledgments page that some of the incidents in this were fictionalized.
Yes.
Now, given our sort of, you know, James Fry, who we mentioned earlier.
Exactly.
You know, does this kind of cast aspersions upon your case study?
Oh, good question. Yeah, well... No, because I don't know. It's like I sort of detail that, you know, all the romantic debacles were actual events. You know, of course I'm going to change names so I don't hurt people. Yeah. And a few characters were sort of hybridized. But I think one reason I just put that out there is so that people wouldn't go to a huge amount of effort trying to figure out who's who, you know, and whatnot. But I don't know. I suppose it could cast doubt on my personal experience, but I think people know, especially I think considering that in almost every chapter I included a bit of an actual column.
Yeah.
So you know it's grounded in what was really happening then.
Yeah.
So I hope that people kind of know that the emotional honesty is very real.
Well, at the same time, there's also the, you know, one might also kind of look at the first names that you drop is a kind of form of name dropping. Why didn't you just change those particular names?
Because there were certain people that I knew that people would know who they were anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, the executive editor of the Chronicle, who's a friend of 25-year friend of mine, you know, like, well, yeah, like, who else would that be except Phil? And you know, I changed almost all the names except for just a few. You know, Phil and Poe, and I think the reason I left Poe is because he had been through a lot of because he'd been a best-selling author, that he was really good with the advice, you know, and sort of helped me really learn how to handle the response and that kind of thing. Who else did I leave as real?
Well, there's like David Vendela, Michael.
Michael? Wait, who's Michael?
Michael Chabon?
You know, somebody else said that. He's not in the book.
Really? No. I could have sworn there was a Michael or something in there. Because I think it was at one of the dinners, yeah.
Michael. Boy, I know. Somebody, that's weird because I read a review that said, you know, Michael Chabon. I'm like, whoa, I don't know him. I didn't put him in my book, so I don't know who that was.
Okay.
But
Control F.
I think I wanted to Control F. Really, I wanted to, I don't know, give sort of a fun and I don't know, fun and glittery look at a certain group in San Francisco, you know, that are friends of mine, and yeah, I don't know. I guess it's name dropping, but it's also they're my friends.
But
so.
Well, that's true. But I mean, it also takes away from your story. It also, you know, sort of. We were talking about, like, well, what's, you know, you can't do everything. You can't necessarily have it all, but you could be very happy.
Yeah.
And so this kind of suggests, you know, this reinforces the notion of, like, oh, well, look, she's, like, hobnobbing with all these interesting people who are also her friends. And yet, you know, she's also kind of complaining about, where's the next Leah? Where's the long-haired man in my life? So, I mean, you know, I'm just wondering why dwell upon this sort of almost celebrity name dropping as opposed to like concentrating on the real story of the book, which is you and your sort of
my journey.
Yeah, your journey. Yes.
I don't know. I did not consider that the and you know, when you say name dropping, I guess I would take exception to that. It's like, you know, as I'm at a party and I say hi to David Vendela, you know, as opposed to David Vendela being big pals of mine or whatever. And I did have that conversation with them at a party about the new column. But
yeah.
Does it take away from the story? I don't know. I hadn't heard that yet, to be honest with you, yeah. that the name dropping aspect.
Well, it's like if I am in a conversation with you and I'm telling you a story, and if I say yes, and I actually did name drop. Well, Mary Gateskill and her punk rock T-shirt. You know, this completely.
That illustrates it for me. That doesn't distract me from, you know, from the message that you were trying to give, I guess. I don't know.
I wanted to actually ask you about your daughter, Erin,
and
how you describe this really sort of very positive relationship, I think. Why do you think that relationship is positive and yet, you know, trying to find another man that doesn't quite always work for you?
I think it's the difference between unconditional love and love that's based on fantasy, to be honest. And also, she's just... Erin's an easy person to love. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. I mean, she gave me fits like every teenager, but you know, she's just a very open-hearted, generous, you know, kind person. In fact, a couple of reviews of my book have, you know, taken me to task, but said she's a remarkable young woman. One called her a remarkable young woman. I said, yes, she is. I can't argue with that.
Yeah, but every mother says that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But yeah. Well, that seems to be the consensus.
No, yeah. I guess, though, I mean, you know, obviously she's a part of you. And obviously she's a part of you to kind of maintain the sort of teenage spirit within a middle-aged woman's body. So, I mean, that I very much got. But I guess I'm wondering, you know, how this relates to the sort of, you know, trying to find a sort of romantic love life or trying to determine whether this you need a love life at this particular point in your life.
I'm not sure I understand. So
I'm trying to ask about the relationship between your daughter and your search for the right man.
Oh, okay.
And also maybe sort of suggesting that, you know, there you do remark upon the fact that you're like a sort of a teenager in a middle-aged woman's body.
Right.
And we had mentioned, you also mentioned when you're looking around for the, you know, right clothes, that there are certain things you just simply cannot wear because society frowns upon it. So I guess... Is this perhaps it, or is this a sort of stigma that's part of the sort of grand equation for why the wandering life, as we've sort of referred to it, is more right for you?
I think the teenage spirit that I share with my daughter is sort of the bond that makes us so strong, and that we both have wanderlust. We love to travel, you know, we're always together. And, you know, it's been detrimental to me in my relationships because I'm not very stick. I don't stick to things very well. I don't have great commitment to relationships. And I guess that's the connection. It's just that, you know, I have this great thing in common with her, this sort of teenage spirit and this restlessness, but it doesn't bode well for, it doesn't speak well to my relationships with men. So.
Or perhaps it's just one of these commitments that is acceptable between you and your daughter that is not acceptable to at least the men you have.
Oh, well, when she was younger, yeah, there was some competitiveness or, you know, that men felt that, you know, I spent too much time on her and not enough on them, which is very possible. But when you're a single mother, it's kind of hard to, you know, put a limit on the amount of time you lavish on your child.
Sure. I wanted to actually ask you, going back to this confessional thing, you write in the book, the worst thing about having several good friends to whom you tell everything is that when you have a quote in initial caps, momentous romantic event, they all demand to know how it went. But I'm wondering about this. You don't necessarily have to tell them everything. Do you tell them everything? What is the sort of threshold of things that you keep to yourself and you masticate upon until you actually are prepared to sort of say, oh, okay, I understand that particular point about my life? Or is your native kind of mode sort of gushing here?
Unfortunately, my innate sensibility is to tell everything, you know, and I've actually gotten better about that in recent years. I've been more protective of my own personal information.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's the columnist in me. I feel like I need to like broadcast, hey, it went awful, it was awful, everybody, it was awful, so that everybody can go, oh, you poor thing, you know.
So again, it's more about the reaction than it is about the confession.
It's probably 50-50. Yeah.
Gotcha. So then why not, you know, what has been the sort of shift? I mean, you know, you could have perhaps with this book dwelt more upon some of the things than you, instead of just spilling them out. So why then did you, you know, again, gush out? Or is this,
gush
or
out.
Are you just so familiar with gushing out these days that it's just, you know.
It was an easy muscle to flex.
Yeah.
I also felt like, you know, I wanted the audience to sort of experience what it was like for me at that time.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, less centered and less focused and less happy than I am now, like 5 years later.
Yeah.
So that was...
Will we get an afterword in the paperback edition of this book just to clarify things that, you know, this was, after all, 4 or 5 years ago?
No, I think people... I don't understand it. Like, I would be confused if readers, you know, it takes a while to write a book. It takes a while to, that people don't really think that people evolve. I don't know. I mean, I figure if you read about somebody writes a memoir about an abusive childhood and they write it in the first person, or not in the first person, in the present tense, you don't assume that, you know, when they write this book 30 years later, that they're still feeling the same things. I guess that would be my justification.
I guess, though, because, like, for example, there's the whole sort of incident where you're, you know, again, going back to this Louisiana guy, where you're rushing to get into shape at the last minute, and you're calling friends, you're even contemplating liposuction.
Yeah, I know, that was absurd.
Yeah, and this to me is sort of, I guess, something that I guess almost every woman goes through at some point.
If it's a really important date, or you think it is.
Exactly. I mean, though, but again, going back to this notion of acceptance, was the writing of this memoir a way for you to sort of perhaps accept yourself, warts and all? And
I think most definitely it was very, I won't say instrumental, but it was very helpful in that regard, to be able to kind of come to terms with where I am now, sort of physically, emotionally, and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is that this column was pitched, and also I've been noticing in the publicity materials for this book, that this is billed as a Sex in the City sort of thing. Why do we have to kind of...
Are they really?
Yeah.
Are they put really?
I read some sort of promotional, I think it was actually with the junket stuff they sent me.
Oh.
And I just was sort of, you know, astonished by this. Why do we have to sort of sensationalize an issue like this?
You know why? I think it's just because it's something that everybody knows about, you know. I'm kind of speechless. I didn't know. And I understand the comparison because I was a columnist and this is about my friends and we live in the city and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know why. I can't answer that. I didn't have anything to do with it. I suspect it's just, you know, you send press materials to all points of the globe, and what does everybody know? Sex and the City. So, but you're right, it's not really the same thing. There's actually, I'm very close to signing a deal for a a sitcom of my book. Which
really?
Is, yeah. Yeah.
We'll have someone
playing
Jane
Goodall. I know, who's going to play me? I know.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that funny? But
Annette O'Toole, I suppose.
And I hope that, yeah, well, maybe. Actually, Annette O'Toole, or somebody said Julianne Moore, but she's not old enough. She's only in her early 40s.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I digress. And so the point is, I guess I was just going to say that the similarities pretty much begin and end with the fact that we're single and columnists. You know, my friend, I've never owned a pair of Manolo Blahniks in my life.
Well, Jane, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Oh, you're so welcome. You write very pointed questions.
Yeah.
You're not the only cuddly toy.